Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas, now in session, pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two causes on its oral agenda. In the order in which these causes will be submitted, they are as follows. First, the State of Texas versus Linda Morales and others from Travis County. And second, Catherine Wilson individually and as executrix of the estate of Gorilla Sandifer, deceased, and others, versus Merrill Winsett, M.D., from Potter County. In the first cause, the court has allotted 30 minutes for each side to present oral argument. In the second cause, 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of their allotted time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of these two arguments, and we'll, of course, conclude both arguments this morning. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court on audio tape. They are also being recorded on videotape by others. If anyone desires to listen to the court's audio tape, you may make application to the clerk of our court. The court is now ready to hear arguments from petitioner in State versus Morales.
May it please the court, Mr. Harry Potter will present arguments for the petitioner. He has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Harry Potter. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here today representing the petitioner of State of Texas. This is a constitutional challenge to Article 21.06 of the Texas Penal Code, which prohibits certain homosexual conduct. Violation of Article 21.06 is punishable as a Class C misdemeanor by a fine of up to $200. The petitioner was a defendant in the trial court. The respondents herein were the plaintiffs. They are five gay and lesbian men and women who are claiming that Article 21.06 violates the right to privacy, their equal protection rights, and due process rights. The trial court held that the statute was unconstitutional and enjoined the state of Texas from any criminal proceedings under the act.
The case was tried on an agreed statement of facts, was it not, under Rule 263?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there are no fact questions.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And there was evidence offered at trial that this statute, the presence of this statute, encourages discrimination against gays and lesbians, was there not?
Yes, there is evidence in record.
That it discourages prevention of AIDS?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that it reinforces a prejudice against gays and violence against gays and lesbians?
Yes, there is evidence in record.
And did the state contest or challenge any of that evidence?
No, Your Honor.
Does the state basically then concede that that's true?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there any challenge at the standing made in the trial court and the Court of Appeals? And if not, why not?
Okay.
Is standing an issue that the court can raise for the first time on appeal?
There was a standing argument made in the trial court, Your Honor. It was based on the fact that a civil court cannot entertain a challenge or enjoin criminal prosecutions of a penal statute absent a showing that a vested property interest has been affected. The Court of Appeals ruled that the property interest distinction was abolished by the Pacell case, which the state vigorously disputes in this case, and held that Pacell expanded it to personal rights in their opinion. And we attack in their opinion that that's incorrect, and second, even if it were not incorrect, the personal rights that are necessary to have a justiciable controversy are not present based on this record in this case.
And what harm is that the case?
The harm that's being alleged is that the presence of the statute makes me uncomfortable with my relationships. Three of the plaintiffs filed affidavits to that effect. That generally it discourages or encourages hate crimes against homosexuals, but none of that was the concrete harm necessary to establish standing of those individual plaintiffs to bring this action.
So it's your claim that perhaps some person who had been denied a job or denied licensing by the state for a certain profession might have standing to sue, but that these individual five claimants do not.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Your position is the mere fact that someone might suffer violence and discrimination from this kind of statute then would not give a court a basis for doing anything about it?
That's correct. The fact that they might suffer it is insufficient. Now, if they in fact have suffered it, then that may in fact be sufficient to confer jurisdiction and standing on those parties to make the challenge.
Did these parties testify? Was there evidence that they engaged in this prohibited behavior?
Yes, the affidavits do establish
that they would be subject to criminal prosecution if the authorities sought to pursue enforcement of the statute.
There is no affidavit by any law enforcement official claiming that they would prosecute anyone.
The statute on its face makes their behavior illegal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
They conceded to the court, or they testified before the court, that they engaged in this prohibited behavior.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Making them subject to enforcement of this criminal statute.
Yes.
And harming them.
That's what the state disagrees with. This is not harm in the legal sense, and certainly not within the doctrines Deering versus Wright.
Criminal conviction is not harmful to your reputation, to your autonomy as an individual in our society.
Oh, certainly it could be if you were actually prosecuted. And that whole line of cases dealing with civil courts enjoining criminal prosecutions talk about having an adequate remedy at law in the event that you are prosecuted.
If, as they argue, they're exercising the protected privacy right under the Constitution, or exercising a right, discrimination against which there is a prohibition because of equal protection in the other constitutional provision, do they not have a right to not be prosecuted under an unconstitutional provision?
That's correct. But the proper mechanism for attacking an unconstitutional penal code provision is in the context of a criminal prosecution.
Someone must
if that ever
themselves to criminal processes before they can contest.
Under Texas law, that's absolutely correct. And the latest opinion on that is covered in the petitioner's brief, is Deering versus Wright. It was a 9-0 opinion out of this court. Prior to that, there was a Canyon Creek case from 1970, and then Pacell is also a landmark case from 1969.
Baker against Wade decision, the Fifth Circuit really goes the other way, doesn't it?
Yes, the federal law is different, and in fact, there is also a 1986 Fifth Circuit opinion that talks about the distinction between the way the state courts treat their criminal proceedings, that must be challenged in the context of a criminal conviction, and citing Deering, in fact, that federal case said that Texas treats it differently as opposed to the federal system.
So the position of the Attorney General is that it is more difficult to get into state court and have this issue considered than it would be to have it considered in federal court.
That's correct, and that's exactly what the Fifth Circuit acknowledged in its opinion. And the distinction there is based on the bifurcation of the courts in Texas. There is no one final court with conclusive authority over both civil and criminal matters. We, of course, have the Supreme Court, this court, which has final authority over civil matters, and we have a Court of Criminal Appeals with final authority over criminal matters.
Are you saying that our sister court, the Court of Criminal Appeals, erred in not taking jurisdiction over this case, or that under the peculiarities of the Texas system, with two co-equal courts, this is simply a case where neither court properly has jurisdiction?
I'm not convinced that neither court has jurisdiction, and I'm not convinced that the Court of Criminal Appeals erred in declining to accept the petition for discretionary review. This case began it was filed as a civil case in Travis County, was docketed as a civil case in the Court of Appeals, and has proceeded all throughout the litigation as a civil case. And if nothing else, I think that this court has a jurisdiction to determine whether or not the other courts erred in a civil proceeding enjoining criminal prosecutions. So I think that there is jurisdiction in this court at least to determine whether or not it was proper for the other courts to have ruled on this matter in a civil context.
There would be jurisdiction if someone had actually suffered an arrest.
There would be jurisdiction if someone suffered an arrest, but given the fact that the lower courts erred, there is jurisdiction to correct that error.
I understand, but there would be jurisdiction perhaps in both courts, one in the defense of a criminal prosecution of the statute in the criminal courts, and perhaps here in the declaratory judgment context, would there not, if someone had suffered an arrest?
If someone had actually suffered an arrest and were tried on those charges, then I think that the the jurisdiction would actually lie with the Court of Criminal Appeals, unless they ran as in Deering versus Wright, if they went to a civil court while the criminal prosecution was going on and obtained an injunction to enjoin that criminal prosecution. Then I think that that presents a slightly different problem. But if this ran its natural course in the context of a constitutional challenge during a criminal trial, that jurisdiction is proper with the Court of Criminal Appeals. And along that line, there's a case cited in our brief where I believe it was in the 1950s where the Court of Criminal Appeals actually reversed a court wearing its equity hat in a civil proceeding, which had enjoined future criminal prosecutions of a penal code provision.
What prosecution is occurring under the statute?
The reported opinions are almost non-existent. They're always coupled with some other crime. It is difficult to tell. I know that the Court of Appeals wrote that the state concedes that it rarely, if ever, enforces the act. My statement was that it is difficult to tell how much prosecution under this act is going on. It's a Class C misdemeanor. I don't know how many people are going to be willing to go through the lengthy court battles to contest a fine that's punishable, or a crime that's punishable by fine only. And second, the lack of written opinions doesn't necessarily reflect that there are no criminal prosecutions. But
well, there is no
evidence in
this record that the 2106 has ever been prosecuted, is there?
There's no evidence in the record.
In this context, there are at least four Court of Criminal Appeal opinions which deal with in the context of sodomy with a child or forcible.
Yes, or public lewdness coupled with a sodomy offense.
But none which would be restricted to private homosexual activity in the privacy of one's home.
That's correct. I've been unable to find any cases dealing with that particular context. And the Kentucky Supreme Court recently issued an opinion declaring their sodomy statute unconstitutional, and the dissenting opinion pointed out that, that was a public solicitation coupled with a sodomy charge, that there is a great amount of difficulty in prosecuting people who only engage in this conduct in the privacy of one's home. You have search and seizure requirements. You have various other constitutional provisions that would make that very difficult. On occasion, those circumstances manifest themselves, and there is at least an arrest. Bowers versus Hardwick would be an example, the United States Supreme Court case, where I believe it was a deputy sheriff went to serve a warrant on someone and walked into the house, and they were engaging in acts of sodomy, and they were arrested. That person was arrested. The DA decided not to press further charges, but that was the arrest itself was sufficient to.
Given your indication that this is the type of thing that would occur in the privacy of one's home, and the lack of any evidence on the part of the state that there's any ongoing prosecution for this offense, exactly what is the underlying state interest behind prohibiting homosexual conduct in Section 2106?
Okay. The statute appears to be simply a moral statement that this conduct is morally offensive to the people of the state. The law has been on the books from the, judging from the legislative history since at least 1860.
But not in this form, of course.
No, it has been amended many times.
And in its current form, of course, deviant sexual intercourse is approved in the state of Texas so long as that deviant intercourse occurs between persons of the opposite sex.
I don't know that I would agree that it's approved, but it is not criminalized.
There's nothing illegal about it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so what interest is it that underlies prohibiting it only with reference to persons of the same sex?
I think that the prohibitions on homosexual sodomy tend to be more deeply rooted, not necessarily only in the context of the Texas statute, but just historically, that homosexual sodomy has tended to be more offensive to the morals of people. And I think that this statute is simply a reflection of that. It is, in fact, a moral judgment, the fact that the statute is on the books.
Given the fact that any ruling that would be made in this case might well have implications far beyond the statute involved in this case, what is the standard then? Is there anything, for example, to prevent the state from criminalizing any intercourse that occurs outside of marriage.
Outside of marriage?
The privacy of one's home.
Okay. It's difficult to speculate on the ramifications beyond this particular case, but certainly anything that occurs within the confines of marriage, I think by your question, we all realize would be protected.
No, I'm sorry. It may be I misstated the question.
No,
what I'm saying is,
outside,
could the state criminalize any sexual intercourse outside of marriage? I suppose the state more or less had statutes to that effect that go back as far as you say this statute does.
I think that that would depend on any record that would be developed in that type of case. It would the standard that I would urge the court to adopt for privacy, I will get to in just a moment, but it would be essentially a two-pronged test. It would be analogous to what the federal system has adopted in determining whether the right to privacy attaches, and that is not simply whether the conduct occurs in the privacy of one's home. The U.S. Supreme Court in Bowers said that it cannot be simply does the conduct occur in private, because otherwise illegal conduct would become immunized simply because it occurs in the privacy of one's home. Rather, the touchstone of the right to privacy should be whether or not the right that's claimed touches on a fundamental right. Is there a fundamental right to engage in the behavior that's claimed?
Is there any reason why, since you agreed to the statement of facts proffered by the plaintiffs in the case, how can you attack factually any of the matters of proof set out in that agreed statement of facts? For example, the state chose not to offer any evidence relating to the public morals function of this statute, as you argue. The state chose not to offer any evidence controverting the public health and safety rationale, which has been offered by the 30 legislators who filed an amicus brief in the case. Why is not your position hampered by the lack of any proof of the state's interest at the trial court?
Because what the state is arguing is that there is a rational basis for the law. And I'll delve into that a little bit deeper later into the argument. But under rational basis scrutiny, the burden of proof is on the plaintiff to negate every conceivable rational basis for the law. The burden is not on the state to prove that any distinctions that were made were legitimate. So this is purely a question of law, whether or not there is a rational basis for the law. The speed limit law would be an example. That would be subject to rational basis scrutiny. The legislature doesn't need to prove that it drew the line at 55 miles an hour because that was some scientific data proved that was rational. Rather, anybody challenging that would have to prove that it was irrational to draw the line at that particular point.
And
the only time
is that the plaintiff's evidence does not meet their burden of proof.
Exactly. And the only time that the burden of proof shifts to the state is if the right to privacy this court determines attaches, then the state must prove that this is the least restrictive means of achieving a compelling interest, the strict scrutiny test. And the state is not arguing that if strict scrutiny were to apply, this statute passes constitutional muster.
But under the Texas State Employees Union case, the polygraph test, a unanimous Texas Supreme Court in 1987 said that there must be a compelling state interest, not merely a rational basis.
That's exactly why this case is so important to the privacy interest. TSEU determined that a right to privacy in fact exists under the state constitution and used federal analysis, Griswold versus Connecticut, Roe v. Wade, federal precedent, federal analysis in determining that a separate right to privacy exists under the state constitution. That opinion, however, did not determine when the right to privacy attaches. It simply held that it applies to polygraph examinations.
But
and this is very analogous.
If it attaches to this conduct, then do you agree that the state would need to show a compelling interest to defeat?
Yes, and I would also say that that is a burden that the state could not overcome.
if a compelling state interest test applies, this statute's unconstitutional.
That's correct.
If a rational basis test applies, then it would be fairly easy for the state to justify a restriction on any sexual intercourse outside of marriage, would it?
I don't know, because it's hard to speculate on cases with that I have no, there is no factual record.
Or a statute that limited the nature of sexual practices even between married adults in their home.
I think that wouldn't even pass federal constitutional scrutiny. If you limited sexual relations between married individuals.
As far as the meaning of the right to privacy in the state of Texas, you're not really suggesting that under the Texas Constitution there's a right of privacy to avoid a polygraph test, but not a right of privacy concerning the sexual relationship between individuals and the privacy of their own bedroom?
Yes, there is a complete distinction between the two. One of the things that TSEU did was acknowledge the right to privacy in confidentiality cases, the disclosure of personal facts. The federal cases have developed two strands of privacy. One is autonomy, and one is confidentiality. This court, in creating the right to privacy or acknowledging the right to privacy under the Texas Constitution, did not make the distinction between the two cases because only one case was before it. It was a confidentiality case. And under federal analysis, confidentiality cases are subject to strict scrutiny, the higher level of scrutiny that this court applied to the polygraph exams. In fact, the federal government also prohibits intrusion by polygraph also. What was not before the court in TSEU was an autonomy case, and this is an autonomy case, the right to be let alone, in other words.
Is it the state's position that if the right of privacy under the Texas Constitution extends to cover this conduct, that public morality, the only argument which you've advanced in favor of this statute, would not be a sufficiently compelling interest to defeat that right of privacy?
That's correct, because the language in TSEU and the analysis of the facts there, MHMR had implemented a mandatory polygraph policy to protect patients, mentally incapacitated patients who were abused or suspected of being abused by its personnel. And the court acknowledged that the protection of these people is, in fact, in some respects, very compelling, but it just simply did not outweigh the intrusion into the employees' personal matters by asking the highly offensive control questions, which delved into this confidentiality matters.
What was the basis for the motive to administer this polygraph examination?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What rationale were they using for wanting to administer a polygraph examination to employees?
It was the protection of the patients that were in the MHMR facilities.
They were protecting
the health,
other
safety,
individuals. Perhaps non-consenting individuals' personal and property rights.
That's correct. And if that is insufficient, then certainly the interest advanced by the state here would not be sufficient
if
the right to privacy attached.
If we accept your narrow reading of the right to privacy under the Texas Constitution, there would certainly be no right of a woman to control procreation or any right concerning abortion, would there?
No, I disagree with that completely. The right to abortion the right to abortion is a separate right, and the analogy that I'll use is the, I guess, concentric circles. The federal constitution still protects the right to abortion, right to procreation, and those decisions. Outside that sphere is the right to engage in homosexual conduct. The fact that Texas decides also that it is not that homosexual rights are outside the sphere of the protection of the right to privacy does not necessarily mean that it does not also encompass, that it does not protect the right to abortion. So I disagree that.
What is the you refer to what's happening in the federal courts. We're, of course, here in the state court. You're not suggesting that we're bound
by
federal decisions.
Not at all.
In terms of our analysis, that we might obtain some guidance from these federal decisions, what is there about the nature of the privacy interest in certain types of sexual conduct in the bedroom of somebody's house, and the privacy interest there, and the privacy interest of a woman with reference to her own body?
It's procreation is the key. It's not just engaging in the sexual act itself, but the right to control whether or not to bear children. And those are two separate and distinct rights. And I will say that if the court were to decide that the right to privacy under the Texas Constitution applied to homosexual rights, I think that decides the abortion issue. Because we have all of a sudden said that our rights are far more expansive than the federal rights. And I think we would necessarily encompass the more important interests that the federal courts have protected. However, I think just the opposite, the mere fact that we decide that the right to privacy does not attach to homosexual conduct does not decide that we will not protect the right of women to have abortions.
Well, Counsel, let me ask you a few questions about the equal protection prong of the respondent's argument. You have conceded that this statute would not meet a compelling interest.
Yes, correct.
Would it, in your opinion, meet the type of mid-level scrutiny that the U.S. Supreme Court has applied to certain classifications, which it finds worthy of, not the highest scrutiny, but certainly more than the
intermediate
minimum level of justification?
I don't know if it would pass intermediate scrutiny, but my argument is that intermediate scrutiny is not applicable to this case, and it's for the reasons stated in the Fifth Circuit's opinion in Baker v. Wade, which dealt with 2106 on rehearing. They dealt with the equal protection challenge expressly and said that this statute is directed at certain conduct. It is not directed at the status of the people involved. It was a very forceful argument that was made on rehearing, and I think that that reasoning applies to our case as well, that it prohibits certain conduct, not status. And I think that's why an intermediate tier of scrutiny would not even apply. We would just simply say, is there some rational basis for the statute?
So you would claim that the scientific inquiry about whether homosexuality is a fairly rigid classification that one cannot change becomes irrelevant, because all this statute would require one to do is simply abstain from
conduct
that frequently attaches to that classification.
Right, or at least certain conduct that frequently attaches. Yes, Your Honor.
Any other questions? I have one more question about the right to privacy, about that area. How would you articulate a test for the state of Texas under our Constitution, under neutral principles, about what conduct should come within a sphere of protected privacy and what conduct is not within that sphere so that the legislature can regulate it?
Okay. I would urge that the court adopt a modified federal approach to determining when the right to privacy attaches. The federal courts attach the right to privacy to fundamental rights, and the term fundamental rights is the same as is used under the substantive due process clause, and there is a two-pronged test on determining what rights are fundamental. Specifically, the first prong of that test is whether or not the claimed right is implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, and that's what I call core values. Is this somehow a core value to our democratic system? And the second prong of the federal test is this claimed right deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions? And I would urge that the court adopt a modified federal approach and substitute state for nation. Is it deeply rooted in the state's history and tradition? And once the court applied that two-prong analysis, with respect to a sodomy statute, the court held that to claim that the right to engage in homosexual sodomy is deeply rooted in the history and tradition of the nation is facetious at best.
Isn't that contrary, however, to the concept that we are a land of liberty and that the state, the government at any level must show some cognizable I hesitate to use the term compelling, but I think it's probably appropriate interest to interfere with any liberty interests that anyone has as far as conducting activities as an individual autonomous being.
Well, see, I think that's the key here is what rights are being protected. And I think that's why we need to adopt the test first. What are the standards for applying the right to privacy? Then we determine whether or not the state has had sufficient reason to intrude into that right to privacy. But first, we must make the determination of when that right applies.
Is it your opinion that this test has worked successfully for the federal courts in
yes.
deciding what conduct is entitled to constitutional protection and what is not?
That's correct. And there was
you believe it's worked in the federal courts, that they're able to use this test in a neutral way without judges imposing their own
views, and that's very important. And the court in Bowers talked about the policy considerations that underlie their reluctance to expand the scope of fundamental rights, and if I could just take one moment to talk about that. The U.S. Supreme Court wrote, "Nor are we inclined to take a more expansive view of our authority to discover new fundamental rights embedded in the Due Process Clause. The court is most vulnerable and comes nearest to illegitimacy when it deals with judge-made constitutional law having little or no cognizable roots in the language or design of the Constitution. There should be great resistance to expand the substantive reach of these clauses, particularly if it requires redefining the category of rights deemed fundamental. Otherwise, the judiciary necessarily takes to itself further authority to govern the country without express constitutional authority." So I think that there are very valid policy considerations underlying the hesitance to expand the reach of these fundamental rights.
Jim, you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. With regards to the standard that you were asking us to adopt, why would not the right to privacy, the right to be let alone, be a core value, even under the test that you've asked us to apply?
Well, the right to be let alone is, as I mentioned, an autonomy right that, at least under federal analysis, is subject to less rigorous scrutiny. And the reason is there's still an impact on others, at least a potential impact on others, even when you're claiming the right to be let alone. And the Supreme Court, talked about how conduct, simply because it occurs in the privacy of one's home, does not become immunized simply because it occurs in private. You cannot possess illegal drugs in private, you cannot possess illegal weapons in private, or engage in incest just because it occurs in private. The right to be let alone in and of itself is not a fundamental right in terms of substantive due process analysis. And I think that's the key, is that we keep those separate and distinct. Certainly there are certain core values that have meaning beyond the substantive due process clause, but that fundamental right phrase has meaning equivalent to what it is in the substantive due process
clause. Well, I guess the answer to the question is how you frame the question. Mr. Brennan took the majority of the task as to how they frame the question. And he said the question is not whether or not there's a fundamental right to engage in sodomy or homosexual act. The question is...
Of course, that's the only question before the court. I mean, we can...
Well, no, that's the question as you frame it. You don't not necessarily have to frame the question the way you want us to frame it. Justice Brennan suggested that the real question is, do we have a fundamental right to be let alone, the right to autonomy, the right to privacy? And that is the question.
And there is a second prong to that test, at any rate. And the second one would be, is it deeply rooted, the claim right deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition?
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please the court, Mr. Patrick Wiseman will present argument for the respondents.
May I please the court, in the plaintiff's opinion, this appeal involves three issues. Whether they're under the traditional notions of standing, we've stated a claim. Secondly, whether the civil jurisdiction issue can take control over a criminal statute. And third, whether 2106 violates the Texas constitutional prescriptions. I don't think there's any doubt about any of those three. And I think it'll be very clear to the court when it analyzes the facts and the law. First, standing. I guess I agonized over standing more than anything, and as always, it was the day before the argument when I found what I think is the white horse case in this regard. I will skip over, because Justice Doggett has already spoken of it, the various facts in the record that lay out the factual basis to the harm. and just simply say that we clearly do show a palpable injury, an injury in fact. And furthermore, even relying on this court's jurisprudence, a constitutional violation is an injury in fact in and of itself. Iranian Muslim Organization, which is out of this court in 1981 and cited in my brief. More importantly, though, I think is the case of Epperson versus Arkansas. And this is kind of a son of Scopes monkey trial case. Scopes was tried in 27 in front of the Tennessee Supreme Court. And of course, as we all forget, Scopes lost. It was a criminal case. After that result, Arkansas passed a similar statute to the Tennessee statute, and it sat on the books for 40 years. And it was never challenged. It was never enforced. And then finally, in Epperson versus Arkansas, a case that's not cited in my brief, 393 U.S. 97, a 1968 case, it finally reached the U.S. Supreme Court. And there the court said, the Arkansas statutes prohibit teaching of evolution in public schools and colleges. It's a criminal statute, the violation of which is a misdemeanor. The Supreme Court noted that there was no record of any prosecutions under the Act for the 40-year life of the statute. Nevertheless, the court had no problems at all with finding that Susan Epperson, the teacher involved in that case, had standing to challenge the statute. I don't think there could be a closer set of facts to our case here on the standing issue.
Ms. Wiseman, can our decision in this case resolve the dispute?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
In the federal system, when the U.S. Supreme Court says you can't prosecute under it, you can't prosecute. In our system, regardless of our decision in this case, ultimately, would not the Court of Criminal Appeals deal with any attempt at prosecution under the case unless we, in the future, assuming we say it's unconstitutional, in the future, then continue to ride herd on the criminal courts by injunction or otherwise saying don't prosecute the case?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, as I will show when I get to that part of my remarks, the state has intentionally bypassed a mechanism that would resolve the comity question between this court and the Court of Criminal Appeals. Has chosen not to use it, although they are aware of it, cite it in their brief, and simply refuse to take the mechanism that is available to decide the case. On top of which, they filed a petition for discretionary review, and the court turned it down. So that the Court of Criminal Appeals has had an opportunity to look at this case. The state had an opportunity to allow the Court of Appeals to defend its jurisdiction if it so wished. And in both of those regards, the Court of Criminal Appeals or the state has decided not to proceed in that direction. So if there's any comity problem between this court and the Court of Criminal Appeals, it's at the hands of the state in their appeal of this case.
Maybe I'm not clear on it. Are you saying that the refusal of the Court of Criminal Appeals to hear this case is their final determination that permits the Supreme Court to go forward and make a final decision in the case, or are you saying that the state somehow has intentionally created this problem?
I'm saying both of those and more, I think. I'm saying first that Passel, which is cited in both the briefs, sets out the standard. So it's clear that this court, in a range of cases, has the authority to decide the constitutionality of a criminal statute. And that's critical for this court to maintain that authority because so many cases flow from tax. I mean, you read the cases, and they're just all over the place, that every time a municipality gets an ordinance passed, they put a $200 fine on it. Along with a lot of other things. And so I think it's critical for this court, if it's going to maintain control of the constitutionality, particularly of irregularly enforced statutes, that it maintain the Passel standard. And I don't understand the state as having challenged PASL. I don't understand there to be any cases that challenge PASL written by this court. All we have to prove under PASL is that personal rights are at stake, either their privacy, that irreparable harm is likely, which, given Iranian Muslim organization out of this court, is clear, and that there's no adequate remedy at law, which is that the state has the option to enforce or not to enforce, and it chooses not to directly enforce, although it creates a whole range of collateral problems for us.
Mr. Weissman, I'm unclear under the reading the briefs and the transcript in the case exactly what your position is on the record of prosecution of 2106. Can you point us to any case in which Article 2106 of the Penal Code has been prosecuted under the circumstances which we're concerned with here, private, consensual, deviant sexual intercourse? Can you point us to any case?
Indeed, I cannot, Your Honor. In a footnote in our brief, the Buchanan case, which is a case that originally declared portions of the statute unconstitutional back in 1970, the court noted in its opinion that even back in 1970, the state was saying we do not directly enforce it. We only use it in these collateral circumstances. And that is what's so devastating to my clients, because they, on the one hand, are stigmatized with the statute, but on the other hand, they cannot simply stand up and take their day in court and argue about it, or at least that's the position of the Attorney General's office.
Let me ask you about the allegation in the plaintiff's second amended petition that the plaintiffs deeply fear prosecution under Section 2106. This fear is real and constant. In light of the inability, I guess, of any of us to identify a case in which this statute has been prosecuted, where does that deep fear of prosecution arise from?
Well, let me put it in a hypothetical. If you were subject at any time to the whims of a prosecutor filing a case against you, whether he or she ever did would not be the controlling issue. What would, I think, control your attitude, your fear, would be that, in fact, it's there at the whim of some prosecutor. And it's not, it's one thing to deal with something, get it resolved, and move on with it. But the idea of taking one of the most important, most intimate parts of a person's life and saying, this is going to potentially affect you from everything from a direct prosecution to whether you can go to law school or be licensed as a lawyer, or you're going to be maybe subjected to gay baiting, or whatever else it may be. That kind of specific fear is something that not only do these clients feel, but it's undisputed in this record. And all of the scientific evidence that's behind that backs that up. If I go back to Judge Enoch's question, the state cites State X Rel Flowers versus Wolfe. And that's a case in which a district court issued an injunction against the enforcement of a penal statute. The state chose not to appeal, but rather in the civil courts, but rather took a writ of prohibition directly to the Court of Criminal Appeals. The Court of Criminal Appeals said, we're not going to consider the merits, but we do know this. And then they tracked the PASL language. They're saying a court in equity can handle all these matters that PASL would allow. This isn't such a case. Therefore, we issue a writ of prohibition against the district court from issuing this injunction. Now, that was a right that the state was aware of. They cited in their brief. And yet, and they could have resolved this concern. It's not one that the plaintiffs don't have that right. We could not take a writ of prohibition to the
My concern, let me sort of, my question was really related to standing. Maybe I should have said that up front, but not the question necessarily you discussed with Judge Enoch, but under our law of standing, there has to be an injury or a threat of injury, just roughly stated. And here, you can see there's this statute's never been prosecuted under these circumstances. So how does this record establish there's been an injury or a threat of injury of prosecution when it's never happened?
Your Honor, I think Epperson is the case in point there. A statute with 40 years of history, never prosecuted, and yet the United States Supreme Court had no problems finding standing that a palpable injury. Likewise, in Baker versus Wade, which is the case, the en banc Fifth Circuit case, which said that under federal standards, 2106 was constitutional, they specifically found that the plaintiff there, who had no better standing than these plaintiffs, had standing.
Of course, you agree, for purposes of this case, we're not bound by anything the federal courts have done, because obviously the cases go the other way on the merits of the case. But we have to be able to identify whether under the Texas Constitution they're standing. And is there anything you could point to other than federal United States Supreme Court authority that would give your client standing here?
I believe those authorities are specifically in point, because under our Constitution, rather than the tightly woven standing requirements of Article 3 of the federal Constitution, our open courts provision says that every person, for an injury done him in his lands, goods, person, or reputation, shall have a remedy by due course of law. Now, that is a broader statement of standing, of justiciability, than you find in the federal courts. So I think, clearly, if the federal courts would find standing under the federal Constitution, this court must, if it is to remain true to Article 1, Section 13, find standing. That is, our standing is broad. We would allow reputation claims, as an example.
Based on an injury.
An injury of reputation. And certainly, if you criminalize something, you certainly injure the reputation of people who engage in it, particularly when it's something like intimate sexual behavior. So, at least I have no doubt that the open courts provision would vitalize Epperson and Baker versus Wade for the purposes of looking at the standing issue. Another issue under this civil jurisdiction matter, and I'm trying to move through my notes as fast as I can, the defendants raised the issue of Deering versus Wright, which is, I think, this court's most recent pronouncement on this issue in Passel and the other cases about civil jurisdiction over a criminal case. And they argue that case means that Passel is no longer good law, or at least that's the way I understand their argument. That is clearly wrong. In Deering, the plaintiff in the civil case was a then defendant in a criminal case, challenging the constitutionality of the marijuana laws, I believe. And also, as the court points out, there were three similar cases that at that moment were pending before the Court of Criminal Appeals. It was under those circumstances that the court determined that there was an adequate remedy, which is one of the three prongs of the Passel test, and therefore the case was allowed to go through the criminal process. That's very different than our case. If there was a criminal case that could be dealt with, we deal with it there. It's this hide and seek that makes it so impossible for these plaintiffs. A second piece of this civil jurisdiction issue is the Declaratory Judgment Act, 3700 of the Civil Remedies and Practice Code, Civil Practice and Remedies Code, excuse me. The Trepanier